Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What makes for a great summer movie? It's been a long time since Americans sought out movie theaters as the only places with air conditioning on hot nights, but our fondness for adventure on the big screen remains undiminished. So with a finite number of Saturday nights left this summer, which of the season's blockbusters would you recommend and which would you steer hapless ticket buyers away from? We welcome your thoughts throughout the hour today at 1-800-933-5372, but we also have two expert guests here in the highly air-conditioned studios of KERA. Christopher Kelly is film critic for the Fort Worth Star-Telegram. Chris Wagner holds the same post at the Dallas Morning News. Guys, welcome back to the show.
Thanks.
Thank you very much.
So, what are the criteria for a really great summer movie? Chris, we'll start with you.
I mean, I don't know if there's any abstract great criteria. I think summer certainly starts earlier and goes longer in the movie industry than it ever did. So you'll start getting stuff in May, early May, that's now summer. And keeps on going. I don't really differentiate the seasons as much as I used to. I mean, my two favorite big films this summer were WALL-E and Dark Knight, and they're both kind of, WALL-E is kind of supposed to be allegedly a kids movie, and Dark Knight is supposed to be allegedly a superhero movie. And to me, they're both very adult pieces of entertainment, very grown up. Entertainment. So the whole mindless popcorn equation just doesn't really work for me anymore.
It's actually nice to have stuff that is not just completely vapid.
It's very nice. Mm-hmm.
I think that's the holy grail of the summer movie, is the great big spectacle that doesn't insult your intelligence. And I think last year we had it with The Bourne Ultimatum, which was such an exquisitely made action movie that I thought was worthy of comparison to Hitchcock. And this year, I think it's The Dark Knight, which I could gush about for hours. It opens tonight. Get your ticket. See it in the IMAX format if you can, because Christopher Nolan has filmed a number of scenes expressly for IMAX. It is... He's taken a superhero movie and turned it into an epic crime thriller worthy of The Godfather or Serpico. It is such an original idea, and Heath Ledger is, you heard it here, is getting the Oscar for this performance as the Joker. He's amazing.
So different from other Batmans. Why?
It's really dense and really dark.
Dostoevskian. Yeah. I mean, it's this serious consideration.
It's not often that you hear Dostoevsky and Batman in the same sentence.
It's insanely serious consideration of goodness and evil and how they just sort of keep sliding back and forth, and what does it mean to be a hero, and all these superhero movies sort of try for this kind of seriousness. This gets it. This is a really, really deeply felt movie, and I thought the real trick of it was it stripped away all of the kitsch and all of the cartoon and all of the color, and you don't feel like you're watching superheroes and supervillains. You feel like you're watching these tortured, agonized, real people wage war for 2.5 hours.
Yeah, I think David Denby in The New Yorker put a pretty funny line. It was like, when Batman shows up, you're like, what's this guy doing here? Oh, yeah, it's a Batman movie. Yeah, it's kind of the novel as action movie, or action movie as novel, which is a pretty strange and, as Chris said, original hybrid. And even at 2.5 hours, it really just kind of goes by very quickly. It moves fast, and it's like I said, it's dense and it's dark, and it's really fleet. It's really nimble, and it's just a very odd and original combination for a superhero movie, and it makes you even consider doubting or not want to call it a superhero movie. Mm.
Well, it's interesting. It sounds like a lot of risks that Nolan took that paid off. Another risky film this summer was the Will Smith vehicle that many people seem to agree did not pay off.
I thought it paid off okay.
Yeah, I did too. I think it's gotten a bum rap.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't think it was a fantastic film, but thought there were also some pretty original elements in that. I love the lengths to which they took the anti-superhero, the very kind of misanthropic, hard-drinking superhero. And then it has a real interesting twist that I certainly wasn't expecting. I don't know if you were.
I rarely gasp at movies, and I said, what?
Yeah, exactly.
And I thought the twist worked for me. It was intriguing. And I think when you see as many summer movies like Speed Racer and Indiana Jones, you'll take anything, you know, after a while, any sort of thing where you're not expecting and it's enough of a surprise. So I appreciated Hancock's effort. It doesn't really work, but it was interesting. It held my attention.
And it does a nice job of giving you, you know, at least what passes for real characters in this kind of movie. You actually feel invested in Jason Bateman's character. You certainly feel invested in Will. So I think it's actually one of Will Smith's best performances. It's one of the best things he's done.
Well, and it's funny, the concept is so cool that you hope that somebody else will try it again in a few years in a different way that works even better.
It felt to me a little bit like Unbreakable, kind of like trying to kind of create one of these anti-superhero movies about the generation of a super, the creation of a superhero. It just didn't, it felt a little bit of a mess. But the performance thing is interesting. Like, it never ceases to amaze me how many amazing performances you will see in these junky summer movies. I thought Charlize Theron, particularly in that one, was amazing. And, you know, certainly in Heath Ledger's performance, you have a performance as worthy of attention as in any so-called serious adult movie. So these are sort of the venues for most big Hollywood stars, and sometimes they really do bring their A-game to them.
Film critics Christopher Kelly and Chris Vogner are with us. You can join us right now at 1-800-933-5372. We're talking about the best summer movies and maybe the worst summer movies as well. How old is Harrison Ford now?
90? No, I think 65.
Old enough to not be making Indiana Jones movies
anymore. So it doesn't work.
Well, I thought one of the things that's funny about that movie is if you're paying close attention, you can sort of count the number of shots where his stunt double is so obviously on the screen and it's not Harrison Ford. And I think there were some scenes where the stunt double was probably on screen longer than he was. It's the whole movie is just so lazy. I mean, I was just sitting there going, they took 20 years and this was this nonsensical X-Files plot was the best they could come up with.
I thought he was fine. I mean, I really didn't think he was the problem with that film. I thought he had a kind of appealing weariness, which unfortunately a lot of the audience might have as well. And I was expecting very little from that film. I mean, it's been so long. I always kind of looked at this film, you know, from far out as kind of a money grab. And, you know, I just don't think that magic is quite there anymore. And I think my low expectations helped me just kind of go with the set pieces and the chases, a couple of which are pretty astounding. I agree with Chris. The payoff is kind of ridiculous, and it just has George Lucas written all over it for me. And in recent years, that is not a very good thing.
What about the score? At least John Williams, you have him to sort of carry you along. Did that help, or did it feel like you were sitting in 1983 again?
Yeah, bring back 1981 and the original one. This one, I just, it really felt like they were just digging into the bottom of the reject pile from the previous three movies. And it felt, you know, Spielberg's really become this amazing executioner of action sequences, and I didn't think any of them were on the level of what we saw in War of the Worlds or previous one was before War, Minority Report. I just didn't think, I don't know, it just felt really flat to me.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Bill in Dallas. Hi, Bill.
Hi. I just wanted to get a little feedback from the reviewers because about an hour ago, I was listening to Fresh Air and heard the review of Batman from a writer from, I can't remember what, New York paper, and pretty much had an opposite perspective on the movie. I mean, he wasn't real thrilled about it. He thought it was entirely too dark, that it never had anything to get you going. And about Heath Ledger's performance also, he said it was... It was so dark, it leaves you feeling that way. So I don't know if any of y'all heard that, but I just wanted to get feedback and see what you thought about that.
Thanks.
I think that was David Edelstein's review, which I haven't either read or heard, but I know David Edelstein is a huge fan of the original Tim Burton Batmans, and I am not. I think they're ambitious, but kind of ultimately silly and a little kitschy. And I think those who really love those two Tim Burton movies, Batman and Batman Returns, are probably not going to be really turned off by this movie, which is not a comic book movie. It's not a superhero movie. It's an anguished, difficult crime movie. And I think that's where the divide on this is going to come down to.
Yeah, I didn't hear the review either. And I'm kind of shocked and scared that I'm agreeing with Chris Kelly so much. But I'm not a huge fan of the Burton Batman films either. I don't hate them, but silly is actually one of the words that I would have used also. And it's not a movie that's going to, you're not going to walk out pumping your fist, yeah, wanting to save the world.
It's bleak.
It is.
And Ledger's performance, one of the things I think is so wonderful about it is it strips away all that sort of Ringling Brothers circus shtick that Jack Nicholson brought to the role, which is entertaining. But Ledger just plays this so, in such a low, tense, nervous register. This sort of ratty, nervous criminal. It's very creepy, and unlike anything we've seen, I think, in one of these comic book villain performances.
Yeah, he's one of the scariest characters I've seen, yeah, in a film in a really long time.
I guess that reinforces the tragedy of what an artist we lost when he died. Is it tempting to sort of read whatever his personal problems were into his performance on screen?
I think probably dangerously so. I'm sort of resistant to do it. I mean, you really get the sense of this guy just pushing himself to the brink of collapse or nervousness or anxiety to pull it off. But I hate kind of thinking about those things. He's a terrific actor. No one's disputing that. And this is a crowning performance. It's sad he's gone.
My hope is that people don't look at the raves that he's getting for this performance and say, oh, well, he died recently, so people have sympathy, and that's why they're saying he's great. And it's hard to separate, you know, what's happened and his passing so recently with this from this film, but he really is just outstanding, I think, by any measure.
And I don't think anyone could look at Brokeback and look at the Joker performances and not say this would have been, you know, one of the greatest actors in film history had he lived a little longer.
I think we can also safely say that neither of you two would praise something that did not deserve praise unless it was there. The new X-Files movie is coming out next week. Have you guys seen it?
They haven't screened it yet. They've sort of kept a close wrap on it. And I got to say, I haven't seen the first X-Files or ever seen the television show. So I'm a bit of an X-Files
neophyte.
I
mean, was anybody asking for this movie like a decade after the last one came out? And
There were some pretty hardcore X-Files fans out there. So I think it will have a core audience. I think people will go and see it. You know, I'm not super excited about it, but it wouldn't surprise me if it was good.
Yeah, I was talking to a publicist from Fox, and apparently their marketing campaign has been squarely focused on the X-Files hardcore fans. And that's not usually how they work it with these summer movies. They go for the hardcore fans, but then try to branch out. They seem to feel like there's enough of those hardcore fans that they'll get a solid hit out of it, and it doesn't need to be a blockbuster. So
stop playing Dungeons & Dragons long enough to get to the movie theater and come back. Actually, I was an X-Files fan too. So 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Let's go next to, looks like, Shauna in Richardson. Hi, Shauna.
Hi, actually, it's Sina.
Oh, Sina, hi.
That's quite all right. I was just calling. I know I'm backtracking a little bit, but I wanted to comment about the Indiana Jones film. I went in with the same low expectations. I loved the first two. The third one was okay. And I expected this to be about on the level of the third film, but I actually really enjoyed it. And I wanted to hear them talk a little bit more about it, just because I think that it's a way to help, like my kids, it's a way to help them get more enthusiastic about the first ones again.
I can see that from a, you know, coming from the perspective of a younger generation. You know, and my big thing with pretty much anything Spielberg does is just the level of craft. And I know it sounds like Chris wasn't as impressed with the set pieces and the chases as I was. There were certainly moments in that film where I just kind of sat there rapt and really caught up. I thought too much CGI for me, too much computer generated. But
I thought the effects looked a little chintzy at points too.
I did too. My favorite sequences were less computer. Like the motorcycle chase near the beginning was probably my favorite scene in the film. So no, I think that's certainly a valid point. If there are kids out there who didn't see Raiders of the Lost Ark and they can use this as a reference point, then that's great.
And who's the female lead in this one?
It's Karen Allen.
And Cate Blanchett's the villain.
Yes, exactly.
The worst Cate Blanchett performance ever.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Christopher Kelly and Chris Wagner are here. They are film critics, and we are talking about summer movies of 2008. Coming up, we will get to more that are on the list and also talk about some of the classics, the things you might want to go back and rent for your summer enjoyment. Back in just a minute.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, a way to keep your greatest two tools, creativity and curiosity, sharp. Details online at smu.edu/MLS.
Why are you so sweaty?
I was watching Cops.
What are you doing?
I'm burying you.
I'm alive, man. I'm alive.
You're waking the neighbors. Shut up.
Legend says that a crystal skull was stolen from a mythical lost city in the Amazon.
We will do this old-fashioned way.
Hancock! I need you to end this.
Hancock is down. He looks hurt.
There are aspects of my personality that I can't control. And when I lose control, it's very dangerous to be around me.
It was a little montage of the summer movies. We heard, in order, Step Brothers, WALL-E, Indiana Jones, Hancock, and Hulk. We are talking with film critics Christopher Kelly and Chris Wagner about summer movies 2008. You can join us via email to think@kera.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. Step Brothers. I have to say, I have a weakness for Will Ferrell movies, as ridiculous as many of them are. Was it any good?
I haven't seen it.
Yeah, I don't think they've... Have they screened it yet? No, if they have, I haven't seen it yet.
I always assume that you guys know everything, like, months ahead of time.
Yeah, no, sometimes they keep them under closer wraps, especially when they're not expecting the critics to gush over them. And I don't even know if I've talked to anybody who's seen this, so...
I haven't either.
The funny thing about that is I would think that you guys would be more aware of that than anybody when they haven't shown you a film, and it would color the way you go into it, knowing that they've hidden it from view.
I think it's too early to say they've hidden it. Usually that's when we know they won't screen it, period. And sometimes I guess if they screen it that Wednesday night, that can be considered maybe sort of hiding it.
But there'll always be surprises where they'll show you it very late and you know, it turns out to be wonderful. So you got to sort of be careful about the, you know, going in with too many expectations. So,
how often do you have a chance to screen a movie that you're going to review with real people and not just an audience full of critics?
It's fine. I mean, I'd be interested to hear what you have to say, but it's the real people thing. I think the only way you can really do that is just to go on a Friday night or with people who actually are paying to see it. Because sometimes it's just the critics, and then other times it's the critics with people who have gotten free tickets and are just so excited to have gotten into something for free.
So you can't gauge the reaction by them.
Exactly. They're not going to complain.
It's $8 worth of happiness or whatever, $10.
Yeah. They either really love it or they really, really love it. So it's hard to, you know, I've seen people clapping at the end of like Christmas with the Cranks. I mean, you pick the worst movie you've ever seen, there'll be people clapping. So it is kind of hard to judge.
Especially if there are free t-shirts and hats involved.
Oh, yeah. Everything changes.
Huh? Yeah. But, you know, for me, it's always fun to kind of bring, like, my folks live in New York, but when they visit, you know, because they're regular moviegoers and they're kind of, and you're just to some of that hype stuff. And American Gangster was a great example, which I know you really liked. I was kind of cold on it, but that was another movie where, you know, you would have walked out of that screening thinking, wow, this is the best movie ever. And I turned to my folks, I'm like, were you guys bored? You know, and they were. And sometimes it's nice to have that kind of regular person barometer with you. So occasionally I'll try to find some people to drag with me, but... So they complain that I hate everything, so they don't want to go with me.
We had Sex and the City at the beginning of the summer, and then it seems like women like vaporized from all the movies. They don't have to be chick flicks, but where are the women?
It's funny. Hancock, in some ways, is a bit of a chick flick. Mm-hmm. Is that going too far?
I think that's... We can't really talk about why that's the case, but yeah, it kind of is.
And, I mean, the Charlize Theron character actually turns out to be perhaps the most important character in the film. And as Chris said, she's fantastic in it. So where that may not be a traditional chick flick, it has that element. And then you've got Mamma Mia on the horizon also.
That comes out tomorrow.
And that's Pierce Brosnan and Meryl Streep.
In the adaptation of the Broadway musical. I didn't much care for it. It's if you love the ABBA songs, it's cute and it's kind of fun, but they really didn't try to open it up. It feels very stagey. And the story is so slight and silly. And if you want to hear some bad singing, listen to Pierce Brosnan sing SOS. Yeah.
You wonder why they had him do his own singing.
Well, I think that was sort of part of what they were going for, a certain kitschy charm. Like, they didn't want, you know, really trained professional singers, which can kind of work, but not when the singing is at such a subpar level. And you have people like Julie Walters. They're just, I mean, they're wonderful performers. They're just not trained singers. And after a while, it's not very interesting to listen to.
I think part of what a lot of people liked about, say, Moulin Rouge was just hearing the actors gut through some of those songs.
Yeah, I think the weirdest modern musical that I've seen was Kenneth Branagh did an adaptation of
Love's Labor's Lost.
Love's Labor's Lost.
That was strange. That.
And it almost felt like a parody.
Yeah.
And it seems hard to do a musical without risking that.
Yeah. And without people who are really going to commit to those songs and bring them alive. And that, I think, finally, after about an hour and a half of sitting at Mamma Mia, you just think, well, what on earth is the point of this? You know, I can go home and listen to my ABBA record if I'm not going to get original, interesting takes on these songs. And it's 18 numbers in the movie, so it's not like, oh, two or three numbers, they're not that interesting. It's the whole movie, you know.
And they pretty much cover the ABBA Gold.
Yes, ABBA Gold minus Fernando. So if you're a Fernando fan, be warned, it's not in there.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. So we haven't talked too much about WALL-E. It seems like there's a crop of animated movies, but you can't compare WALL-E with like Kung Fu Panda or Speed Racer.
I'm going to be contrarian, actually. I liked Kung Fu Panda better than WALL-E. I like them both. My beef with WALL-E, I felt, was that Pixar, which is very ambitious, sometimes lets their pretensions get the best of them. And I felt that way with The Incredibles, which is, I thought, they're kind of making art movies for kids, and particularly WALL-E, where the first 40 minutes there's very little dialogue, and there's all these allusions to 2001 and Jacques Tati and Charlie Chaplin movies. It just became a little full of itself after a while, and I found the characters kind of a little inexpressive. We're grading kind of a higher curve. Mid-level Pixar is still pretty impressive, but what I liked about Kung Fu Panda, on the other hand, was a very simple story, beautifully rendered. The colors and the images in that I thought were spectacular.
I haven't seen Kung Fu Panda, but WALL-E is my number one of the year so far, and it's funny. I can certainly see why people would say it's an art film for kids. I actually think it's an art film for adults who want to take their kids to something that, you know, won't be totally over their heads or bludgeoning them in the stomach.
And then they can all go to Whole Foods afterwards.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, there's an anti-obesity kind of message to the whole thing.
Well, it's funny. It has a sort of a, you know, what is humanity becoming, and especially what is our culture and society becoming message. So it's
Did you find that a little bit cynical, though?
No, I thought it fit in with a lot of the great sci-fi that I've seen over the years. I thought it was really gutsy, and I just loved the love story between these two robots who barely speak. It just kind of forces the filmmakers to turn it into sort of pure cinema, where you're relying exclusively on images and sound and almost no dialogue. I love that kind of stuff.
It makes me think of Miyazaki's work, which is so much about, you know, sort of greed and consumption. Is there anything, I guess visually it doesn't look anything like that. Did you feel references to that work?
Well, the greed thing is interesting because they get into outer space and everybody's turned fat and incapable of moving. And, you know, they're all sort of slaves to corporations. And I always sort of cringe when it's Disney giving me this anti-corporation message. Like, really?
Buy Disney's low-fat snacks.
Yeah. It felt a little cynical to me in terms of sort of saying America's become this sort of bunch of, you know, overweight and anesthetized, you know, people. But I don't know. It's sort of spilled over into like talk radio. Like, I think conservatives are sort of saying it's this attack against America.
Yeah.
So I don't know if I'd go that far.
I think Miyazaki is a little more overtly dark. The actual images in Miyazaki films can be very scary. And sure, the messages are also. But I don't think there's much subterranean to disturb you.
He's probably
Miyazaki.
more overtly cynical too.
And I love Miyazaki. I'm a big fan. It's just, to me, it's not. I would take the kids to go see WALL-E. Say if I had kids, before I would take them to see, say, Howl's Moving Castle, mm-hmm. or something like that, which I think could cause some serious nightmares, not to mention a few therapy bills down the line.
Yeah, there's never a full resolution when it comes to that, to Howl's Moving Castle or Spirited Away. It's always, you're always sort of left damaged.
Yeah, exactly.
What about Sex and the City? Did you guys like it?
Ugh.
Happy to say, didn't see it.
I was actually on vacation when it came out, which I was grateful for because I liked the show and I wasn't much interested in seeing it revisited. And then when it turned into a hit, I did kind of out of professional duty feel guilty enough to drag myself to it. And it is dreadful. I mean, it was just so lazily imagined. They didn't advance any of the characters. It looked horrible. I mean, the clothes were beautiful, but the lighting was so harsh on
somebody.
Yeah, I mean, one of the, like, Sarah Jessica Parker and particularly Cynthia Nixon, I just thought were dreadfully lit. I mean, just real simple, basic filmmaking things were so off in this movie. And the story was just pointless and endless, and it really felt like just such a money grab. I just thought it was so cynical from start to finish.
I was always more of a Sopranos fan. I shudder to think at what Hollywood might do to that someday.
You think there will be a movie?
Yeah, probably. Mm-hmm.
Where there is money, there is a movie, yeah.
Precisely.
I kind of felt that way about the Simpsons movie, which all of my movie references are going to be from a year ago because I see things when it comes out on TV. And I was looking forward to that one, and it didn't feel like anything special.
I thought it was fine. I thought it was a long episode, which is good to me because I like most episodes, but I don't think it broke any ground other than being able to get away with a few things content-wise. It wasn't particularly earth-shattering.
Yeah, and that's what the trap Sex and the City fell into, was it didn't advance the characters beyond what they had already gone through in seasons 5 and 6. I mean, you saw all of these arcs previously. They just did them all over again.
And was that another case where they were going for that core audience as opposed to people who were beyond watching the show?
I guess. I mean, I think they got their core audience. I mean, they created sort of a phenomenon out of it. I just shudder to think like how low people's expectations are or their standards are if that's the kind of movie they, you know, want to see. And they're going to make another one, is my understanding. It's just, God, I hope it's not as lazy as this one.
And keep in mind that we are not the core audience for.
No, that's true. No,
I did watch the show. I always enjoyed the show. So maybe I was the core audience. And
we've talked a lot about sort of big budget blockbuster movies, but of course there's always independent films. Anything on the smaller scale that you guys have really liked this summer?
You know, it's been a weird year because there have been very few art movies that have had the chance to break out commercially. And I think with the exception of maybe Young at Heart, the documentary about the older people in the chorus, nothing's quite broken through. There's a movie I love called Reprise, which is a Norwegian film, which I'm sure no one has seen, but and didn't play very long here. But it seems to me it's been sort of low season for art movies.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. I mean, I'm not a great movie, but I'm a huge basketball freak, and there's a film called Gunnin' for That Number One Spot that came out a couple of weeks ago that's directed by one of the Beastie Boys, Adam Yauch, and it's basically some of the best high school basketball players playing in this game at Rucker Park in Harlem, which is kind of a cathedral for street basketball. So that gave me my basketball Jones for the summer. I can't really tolerate summer league games. They're pretty sloppy. So that, you know, I certainly enjoyed that. And I liked Young at Heart quite a bit. The documentary that Chris referenced about the senior citizens in the chorus group singing rock and roll songs by Sonic Youth and other bands. I walked out of that feeling kind of elated and life affirmed.
And this summer, there's been no Waitress, there's been no Once, there's been none of those sort of mid-level kind of Indiewood movies that have broken through. Brideshead Revisited, which I'm going to run from the studio to the screening of this afternoon, might fill that spot, but I don't know.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Christopher Kelly and Chris Wagner are here. We're talking about summer movies. You can also email us about your favorites or your least favorites. That goes to think@kera.org. Have you noticed any fallout from the writer's strike? This seems like it would be about the time that maybe movies in production now are the ones that would really be affected.
Does that help explain the lack of the Little Miss Sunshines and Onces? Perhaps, or
faster to produce things.
I suspect that just might have to do. Well, I don't know. I mean, I think at Sundance this year they were looking for these kinds of movies because they needed to fill up the slate and couldn't find them. I think it might just be a case that the products kind of dwindled a little bit, and it's harder and harder now to get people to pay attention to smaller movies. You know, when there's so many other options, I think a lot of the indie studios are really facing a coming crisis because it's hard to get the theaters, it's hard to keep them in theaters, and you know, it's getting worse.
And a lot of people didn't go to Sundance this year, including the both of us.
Yeah, exactly.
I think it's getting a little bit cost prohibitive.
The papers are saying, yeah, you can just get the AP. And
yeah, pretty much. Mm-hmm. I mean, and Sundance has always been expensive to go to, and now it's just getting ridiculous. And I think they're even starting to worry about that a little bit. So the films may be out there coming later, and they're not quite on our radar yet.
Yeah.
We have an email from Madhvi who says, I wanted to ask why you guys have not mentioned Hellboy 2 yet.
Because it was terrible. Did you see it?
I didn't see it. I like Guillermo del Toro. I will probably try to see it at some point. I haven't been to a lot of screenings lately because I'm going to be taking a little break from reviewing movies. So I feel like I say that only because I keep saying, I haven't seen it.
Can we talk about your upcoming gig? Or is that still a secret?
No, it's not a secret. I'm taking a year off to study at Harvard. and watch, if I'm going to watch movies, but I'll watch them for pleasure for the time being, which I do as a critic also. So.
What a strange experience that will be to not have that hanging over your head.
It will be lovely.
So why did you hate Hellboy?
Well, I should say that I think Guillermo del Toro is an incredibly gifted and elegant filmmaker. I just don't really buy any of his movies, including Pan's Labyrinth. And I just find them creatures and goo and things exploding. And I don't think there's much heart to them. I think he's really kind of overrated. And this one, to me, is just, you know, this was one of the few movies I couldn't follow the plot within 30 seconds, maybe. I mean, I had no idea what was going on and the opening credits hadn't rolled.
So it's a bad song.
It's just such fanboy silliness. There's an audience for it if you like it, you know, Godspeed, but it's not my thing.
I like a couple of his films very well. I really liked The Devil's Backbone,
which is the least effects-driven of his works.
Yeah. I thought that was a really penetrating, well-done story and very haunting. I actually like it better than Pan's Labyrinth.
What was the decision on the Sarah Marshall movie? I have never seen so many billboards and bits of advertising for a movie as I did for that one.
Pretty big marketing blitz on that one with the little notes saying, "Sarah Marshall, you ruined my life."
Right. Yeah. Was it worth it?
Or whatnot. I didn't think so.
What? That's my hole for the year. I still haven't caught up with it.
I think they really wanted it to be this summer's Knocked Up, because Knocked Up was a kind of a smash hit.
Was it also Judd Apatow?
Last year, yeah. Mm-hmm. It seems like every other comedy that comes out these days, Judd Apatow is connected to somehow as a producer or a writer, occasionally as a director. It's not a bad film. It's a nice comedy. I don't think it's Knocked Up.
So we can wait for video.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, it's probably out of the theaters now anyway. But 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We'll take more of your calls when we come back. Also, you can send email to think@kera.org. Chris Wagner, film critic for the Dallas Morning News, and Christopher Kelly, film critic for the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, are with us talking about summer movies.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, a way to keep your greatest two tools, creativity and curiosity, sharp. Details online at smu.edu/MLS.
I had a vision.
Scully?
So you believe in these sort of things?
Let's just say I want to believe.
You've changed things.
People are dying. What would you have me do?
There's been speculation that I'm parading around as a superhero. I'm just not the hero type, clearly.
This is the mind-numbing black hole I call a job. And this is me. Wesley Gibson.
This is what's been missing from your life, Wesley. Purpose. All you have to do now is embrace it.
Those were clips from some summer movies, including The X-Files, Batman, Iron Man, and Wanted. We are talking about summer movies with Christopher Kelly and Chris Wagner. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372, and that's where we find Michael in Fort Worth. Hi, Michael.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I love this show.
Thank you.
I had a quick question. I was going to go see the Batman on IMAX movies, and I was just curious what they thought about IMAX shows being blockbuster hits, though.
Well, Dark Knight's actually a very unusual, and I think first of its kind case where Christopher Nolan filmed five or six action sequences for the IMAX format, where it fills up the whole IMAX screen. But the rest of the movie is in traditional aspect ratio, a traditional, I guess, 2.35 to 1 aspect ratio. So it you think that might be jarring because he jumps back and forth, but it's seamlessly executed. And I really, really urge you, if you can, to see this on the IMAX format. I guess there's a couple of theaters in the Metroplex that are going to allow you to do that. So if you can, get a ticket to that one. I guess this does sort of speak to the fact that filmmakers are using IMAX a lot more and these 3D technologies like Beowulf last year. So it's certainly interesting. It's fun to watch.
Yeah, I saw Batman in the non-IMAX form, the traditional, and now I really want to see it in IMAX. And I'm not a huge IMAX fan. I like it for things like nature movies and concerts, not so much for more traditional narrative Hollywood movies. But I've heard so much about how the IMAX is executed for Batman that that's probably going to be the next movie I see.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Lance in Dallas. Hi, Lance.
Hi, how are you doing?
Great, thanks.
Hey, I was just going to talk about WALL-E. The opening actually brought back memories of a Bruce Dern movie called Silent Running, which a lot of people probably aren't aware of, about the horticulture ships that were in outer space because Earth was no longer viable to grow plants and stuff.
That's a Bruce Dern, right? 19-something?
Yeah. And then at the end, the one robot that survived was left in one of the horticulture ships when all the ships went back and they destroyed the horticulture domes. So that's kind of what it reminded me of. Really good movie.
I'm going to have to go back and look at that. I saw it when I was a kid, actually, and it's a kind of, I think it's Silent Running is a little more tongue-in-cheek, if I remember correctly. It's a little more irreverent than WALL-E, but that actually sounds like a pretty good comparison.
We have an email from Kathy who says, the best art house movie of the summer so far is The Visitor. What do you guys think?
I really liked The Visitor. Was it a summer movie or was it a...
It's been out a while now.
Yeah, spring movie.
It's kind of caught on.
I think it's a very good film, actually. Richard Jenkins is in it. He was the dad on 6 Feet Under, and he actually worked at Dallas Theater Center for a number of years.
He's being talked up for an Oscar nomination for that.
Yeah, and I would be happy to see him get that, actually. So, yeah, see The Visitor if it's out there, and if not, then rent it when it comes out.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Email address is think@kera.org. Steven asks, any thoughts on The Whackness?
Yeah, sure. I'm a big hip-hop fan, and that probably The Whackness, which actually opens... It opened last week, right?
I think that's right.
Probably the best hip-hop soundtrack I've ever heard. And I say that because it's a period, 1994, and when the story is set in a place, New York City, that I think is the best time and place for hip-hop. I think that was the last great period of hip-hop. And the movie itself is good. The music is used really well. And just the thrill of hearing, like Nas on top of Tribe Called Quest, on top of Biggie Smalls, when all of these artists were at their absolute peak, for me anyway, was really, really exciting. So I would say if you have any, even a small interest in hip-hop music, I would rush out and see it.
I haven't seen The Whackness yet, but a plug for the director, Jonathan Levine, who made a really interesting horror movie called All the Boys Love Mandy Lane, which still has not been released, despite the fact that it's about 2 years old now. It got caught up in one of these release, one studio got rid of it and another one picked it up. It'll eventually be on DVD, I'm sure, but he's a really gifted young guy, so I'm looking forward to The Whackness.
And that one was a Texas film.
Yeah, the director is actually shot in Austin.
Yeah, he's from New York, but he came out to Austin in the Hill Country to shoot it.
It's a nice kind of gloss on Texas Chainsaw Massacre,
sure,
and things like that.
With a clever feminist twist to it.
It's a smart movie.
I'm going to have to add that to my list after that description. 1-800-933-5372 is our phone number. Let's go next to Nancy in Denton. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. I was going to comment on, I was going to repeat a comment. My 6-year-old grandson, after seeing WALL-E, I took him to it on Tuesday this week, and we have a lot of in-depth conversation about some of the not so subliminal messages. But the first thing I said to him was, well, there wasn't a lot of talking in the first part, was there? And he looked at me very seriously and he said, no, but there was a lot of love.
Oh,
yeah.
High praise.
Yeah, I wouldn't argue with
that. I agree with that too.
We did have an email from somebody who said that the Let's see. The height of irony during viewing Wally was the Chinese-made plastic throwaway watches that the theater gave my daughters before viewing a movie, lecturing on the evils of an excessive consumer society.
That is an awesome email.
That's from Bob in Arlington. So thanks for that, Bob. And maybe you can recycle the plastic watch. 800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Vincent in Fort Worth. Hi, Vincent.
Hi, how you doing?
Great, thanks.
I had a observation and a comment and a question actually on your guest. I'd like to know what they thought about a movie that was released a little while ago. I just rented it on DVD. It's The Diving Bell and The Butterfly. And I was about, I don't know, three quarters of the way through that movie, and I thought, man, I'm going to just shoot myself in the head. Does that make me a bad guy that I don't like foreign subtitled movies? And I'll take your answer off the phone.
Thanks for your call.
That reminds me of when I was watching Spike Lee's Katrina documentary, and I turned to it turned to the person I was with about 3 hours in, and I said, does it make me a bad person that I'm bored out of my mind sitting through this? I loved The Diving Bell and the Butterfly, which for people who don't know what it is Julian Schnabel's portrait of Jean-Dominique Bauby, the late French L editor who was paralyzed, and it's a rendered through his point of view, so through the basically one blinking eye of this paralyzed man. It's I thought it was just magnificent. I've seen it four times. I don't know if it translates very well on DVD. I haven't seen it on the small screen, and I've heard from people who saw it just on DVD that it didn't really work for them.
It's funny. I thought it was actually a pretty inspirational film. I thought it was for a film about a guy who's, you know, all trapped in his own body and can only communicate with his eye, actually left feeling kind of uplifted.
I think it's just such an image-dependent movie, and it's such a painterly movie, and so attuned to texture and light that seeing it kind of with so many distractions in your living room might really kind of make it hard to get through.
Did The Bucket List come out this summer, or is that older than
that? That was a December release that I think they were trying to get an Oscar nomination for.
It seems like people are still kind of bringing this up, and it was one of the movies I actually saw, and I thought it was horrible.
Horrible is probably too kind a word.
I thought the message of The Bucket List is if you're a multimillionaire, there's a lot of really cool things you can do right before you die.
Yeah. And don't wait.
That falls into my subgenre of movies, which I call Please Die Already. Because after about 10 minutes, I sort of wanted to see those two expire.
It's funny, though. There are people in my life that I can think that I would recommend that movie to because everybody knows that person or persons who that's their kind of movie.
Sure.
I think its message is indisputable. You know, I mean, who's going to argue with a movie that says, you know, seize the day and do, you know, everything you can before you die? It's just such a clunky execution and badly acted. I mean, they barely are acting. You know, they're just sort of being Jack Nicholson and Morgan Freeman.
I know. And you'd think that it couldn't be bad if both of them were in it.
Yeah. Well, you throw in Rob Reiner as the director. That's a pretty toxic mixture. So
there was no sexual gratification scene. We could be thankful for that. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Jake in Rockwall. Hi, Jake.
Oh, hello. Good afternoon. I happen to be driving along listening to your guests, and I had earlier saw on the internet where the Pope Benedict had said something about the movies and thinking and trying to exploit violence and sex more as entertainment. And my wife has an art gallery, so we're more into art. But I just wondered if the guest could speak to the emphasis and the priority of the sex and violence with the American people as opposed to true art and really quality artists, you know, that actors that make you really feel deeply about something. And I'll just hang out.
Thanks for your call, Jake.
I agree with some of that. I would add that one can feel deeply about sex and violence if it's presented in a certain way and if it's part of a story, if it's not just being gushed up there on the screen. Unfortunately, it often is just being gushed up there on the screen. So I don't think sex and violence are entirely separate from art. I don't think they ever have been, really. But I think there's a lot of very cynical filmmaking that is, he asked about, you know, sort of how it fits into the society. I think our society is addicted to violence and has a real hard time with sex. And I think a lot of movies reflect that.
Have either one of you seen, Gerald writes, the French film Tell No One?
Heard great things.
The DVD has been sitting on my television for about a week, and I cannot wait to see it. I've heard excellent things as well. So,
how do you put things in order when you guys have multiple things that you've got to see?
I actually literally have a stack of, if it's on DVD, some of these smaller films we usually see on DVD, and I'll get them and just kind of juggle them. If I know I have to write about it, that's kind of what comes first, and you invariably fall behind. I'm sure you have a million things you are like, keep saying, I'm going to see that.
Yeah, it's really about what the deadline machine requires from week to week, unfortunately, and sometimes you can squeeze in things for pleasure that you've been meaning to get to, but usually you just keep meaning.
Yeah,
to get
it's a bad job to take a vacation with, because Wanted, I was out of town for the screening, and I'm dying to see it. I just, you know, it's hard to kind of squeeze in.
Now, does it pain you to pay for it?
Well, I could probably get the ticket reimbursed. So no, but it's more just like, you know, I think Larry McMurtry was talking about this before, is you don't quite want to take your pleasure time and make it your work time all the time. So, and that's kind of what it becomes.
Let's speak next to David in Ferndale. Hi, David.
Hi, how you doing?
Great, thanks.
Before I ask my deeply philosophical question, I was watching cable last night, and two movies came on back-to-back that are pretty old. I wanted to find out what they thought about them and then ask my deeply philosophical question. But they had L.A. Story, the old Steve Martin comedy, which I thought was a multi-layered, was really a brilliant movie. And then after that, The Dish, which is, I think, one of the most underrated movies of the last decade or so. The Australia, are you familiar with that one?
I'm familiar with it. Actually, I didn't see it.
And David, let me have you go quickly to your deeply philosophical question, because we're running out of time.
The deeply philosophical question is, how have action movies changed over the last 5 or 10 years? It seems like there's a lot more thought that goes into them now, more philosophy and moral intrigue and that sort of thing. And I'll take it off the air. I was just curious.
Great question. Thanks.
Thanks.
I think that is a great question. I think a lot of it... The Matrix, I thought, was a definitive movie in two ways, both in trying to sort of push the intellectual caliber of these movies, of the action spectacles, up many notches, but also the technique and the using the effects to tell the story. And then, you know, film historically, I think then that Peter Jackson, Lord of the Rings trilogy, kind of took that up another notch. And now you have these directors like Paul Greengrass, who did United 93, but who also did the last two Bourne movies, who are applying just real intelligence of thought and amazing technique. And I think this is sort of a golden age for those kinds of action movies, you know.
Yeah, I would agree with that, with one caveat. I think a lot of action movies are getting really lazy with the computer-generated effects and kind of slathering them on, and not necessarily, certainly not the Bourne movies. That's kind of the antithesis of computer-generated effects. But if you look at something like The Hulk, which I thought was okay, even parts of Hancock, I thought didn't quite work. In fact, they were almost seemed to be mocking the whole CGI thing at times. So yeah, I think they were gotten more complex morally and sometimes intellectually and sometimes lazier visually.
And with seconds to go, L.A. Story and The Dish? Thumbs up, thumbs down.
L.A. Story, lots of fun. Saw it years ago, and I'm from California, so I certainly enjoyed the satire element of it.
And The Dish gets an eh.
The Dish gets an I didn't see it.
I just remembered what it was, and it's eh.
Christopher Kelly is the film critic for the Fort Worth Star-Telegram. Chris Wagner does the job for the Dallas Morning News. My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.